Hey, Prime members, you can listen to Tides of History ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the app today.
The rumble of thousands of booted feet, hooves, and the wheels of cannons and supply wagons shook the pavement. Metal sword hilts clanged against steel breastplates. The clamor of a half dozen noisy varieties of French and German mixed and melded above the racket. The stink of thousands of unwashed bodies sweating even in the winter chill permeated the air. This was an army on the move, an army led by the French King Charles VIII. A new era of European power politics was about to begin. It was December of the year 1494. Charles VIII had invaded Italy with a cutting-edge army of professional cavalrymen in shining plate armor and advanced artillery capable of blasting holes in the wall of any medieval castle. There were 8,000 stone-faced Swiss mercenaries. Their hedgehog formations, bristling with 15-foot pikes, could roll through any opposition. This was the most advanced army money could buy. What paid for that army was a professional bureaucracy that assessed and collected taxes on an industrial scale. The Tuscan peasants who watched the soldiers pass by had never seen anything like this. No, they weren't strangers to war. The city-states of Italy fought each other constantly, but they'd never seen so many cannons. They'd never seen the tough, hard-bitten Swiss professionals. Most of all, they'd never seen so many soldiers all at once. Italy was about to become a battlefield for states whose resources and destructive capabilities were miles beyond anything these peasants had ever seen or could even comprehend. There was something new, something truly frightening happening here. From this vantage point, standing here by this ancient road, we can see the roots of a world that's recognizably our own. From Wondery, this is Tides of History. I'm Patrick Wyman. Welcome to the first episode. One of my favorite historians, Fernand Braudel, wrote, "Events and even individual people are just crests of foam on top of the waves that the deeper tides of history carry on their strong backs." I'm a historian. I've spent the better part of the last decade working on the period from roughly 300 to 700 AD, the fall of the Roman Empire. That's what my PhD was on. It's a period in history that I focused on in my last podcast, The Fall of Rome. If you've been listening to that show, don't worry. Everything you liked about that one will still be here, too. And it's a time that's always fascinated me because it tells us that no matter how deeply rooted the foundations of our world seem, things can still fall apart. Nothing lasts forever. People living in the Roman Empire in 425 couldn't imagine a world without it. Just as we're conditioned to think of ourselves as living in an eternal America, Canada, or United Kingdom. 50 years later, though, the Roman Empire was gone. It took another 50 years after that for people to come to terms with it. That's a relative blink of an eye in the grand scheme of things. Now, I'm not done talking about Rome. Far from it. There are still so many questions left to answer, like, what was happening in the eastern half of the Roman Empire, the part that didn't fall apart? Why did cities decline and disappear? How and why did Christianity come to dominate the religious scene? How did a changing climate play into all of this? Rest easy, we still have plenty left to discuss. But in this new series, I'm going to be doing something a bit different as well. I've always been fascinated with big changes, with the big questions of history. There's another topic that's chock full of these kinds of shifts, things that rocked the very foundations of the world. I'm calling it the rise of the modern world. And this series will cover the period between about 1350 and 1650 AD, roughly the Black Death to the Thirty Years' War and the English Civil War. Why this time? Well, because as the title implies, I think this is where the roots of our world, the world we see around us every day, are to be found. So, when I was in graduate school, we were never taught to talk to a general audience, or even really encouraged to do it. We were supposed to write for specialist academics. Essentially, we were making our work inaccessible to the broader public. On one hand, that makes sense. You're dealing with esoteric topics and you need to be precise and specific. On the other hand, though, you're explicitly cutting yourself off from interested people who might like to know more about the past. It might sound corny to say this, but I genuinely think history matters. It's an incredibly powerful tool for understanding our own world for two reasons. First, it tells us how we got to where we are now. That's important to know. It's pretty hard to have a full understanding of our life and times without grasping the roots of the things that define us, from the legal system to race relations. Second, though, history tells us that the world doesn't have to be as it is. Things weren't destined to happen the way they did. The way we've organized things, whether we're talking about the structure of the state or the definition of marriage, it's not the only possible way to do it. Labor systems, religious experience, even basic assumptions about how people relate to each other, none of that's set in stone. In that sense, I think history should be useful. It should try to explain why the world is the way it is and why it's changed over time. It should strive to give people examples and comparisons with which to think both about the past and the present day. By that, I don't just mean reading the present back onto the past. As Mark Twain put it, history doesn't repeat itself, but it does rhyme. History gives us tools to think with. It helps us figure out what questions to ask and how to frame our answers. These two topics, the fall of Rome and the rise of the modern world, give us a lot of opportunities to do just that. I already mentioned a few things we'll be discussing with regard to the fall of Rome, but let me give you a brief outline of what we'll be covering here in the rise of the modern world. The sovereign state rose out of the messy politics of the later Middle Ages to vanquish its opposition, becoming the structural and institutional basis of the nation-states we still inhabit today. Wars increased in duration and intensity, while armies changed from temporary feudal levies dominated by archers and knights to standing armies of professionals with firearms and cannon, paid for by a complex state apparatus of taxation. The beginnings of capitalistic economic logic can be found here, too, in financial markets and accounting practices that seem familiar to us today. If you've ever had to deal with an Excel spreadsheet, you can thank Florentine bankers and their double-entry bookkeeping for that. The printing press fundamentally transformed communication and the accumulation of human knowledge. That was just one of a host of technological innovations that came to fruition around this time. Scientific practices evolved as well, proving that the Earth rotates around the sun and eventually culminating in Newton's great discoveries. The Renaissance produced an incredible cultural efflorescence in art, literature, architecture, and thought. Some would even say that the concept of the individual, as we understand it, was born in the cities of northern Italy in the 14th and 15th centuries. Centuries of religious dissent spilled over into the Protestant Reformation, as figures like Luther, Zwingli, and Calvin toppled the formerly universal church and splintered European Christianity once and for all. Finally, ships set off from Western Europe, bound for destinations around the world, knitting together the world from Calcutta to Lisbon, Seville to Cuba, and London to Newfoundland in a web of trade, migration, and violence that would rewrite not just Europe's history, but that of the entire world. We're still living in the world all of these big developments created. Sure, a lot of stuff has happened since then, including an industrial revolution and a couple of world wars. But in meaningful ways, the foundation of our own world was laid in this 300-year stretch from 1350 to 1650. The world in 1500 was still a medieval one, but the modern lay just around the corner. On a more personal level, this long early modernity and the end of the Roman Empire are the two periods of history that have always fascinated me the most. You might ask, why not cover the 800 years in the middle, from the Vikings to the Crusades to the Black Death? Well, the short answer is, I plan to, eventually. In fact, that's probably going to be the period that we dig into once the fall of Rome has run its course. That's one of the nice things about history. It's not going anywhere. My goal here is to bring you the most up-to-date conclusions and viewpoints of people who've spent their whole lives working on the two periods in question. Academic history is great, but on a really fundamental level, it's not aimed at the general public. It's intended to be read by people who already have a deep grounding in that material. If you don't have that background, it's dang near incomprehensible. To some extent, that's necessary. Specialists in every field have their own technical language, whether you're pouring concrete, arguing before the Supreme Court, or writing code. It's shorthand that allows these specialists to communicate effectively and efficiently, with the kind of nuance and precision that's necessary among the initiated. On the other hand, though, this kind of technical language and background necessary for understanding the material also serves as a way of blocking off that material from the uninitiated, from outsiders. This is where it becomes a real problem. It makes the enormous amount of interesting stuff historians have found inaccessible to the general public. When academic historians shake their heads at the state of public knowledge of an issue, as they regularly do, a lot of that has to do with the gap between what they're writing and what people are actually reading or listening to. I see it as my job to make this inaccessible material accessible. I want to translate it for people who are interested in these topics, but who don't have half a decade to spend in graduate school to learn this technical language, or to absorb all the necessary background to understand it. Here on Tides of History, I'll do that part for you. I'll read the archaeologist's distribution maps of 5th century pottery and the analyses of a 16th century merchant's account books. I'll read the linguistic theories on the emergence of proto-Romance and the mind-numbing records of how 17th century bureaucrats collected and spent tax funds. There's a vast amount of stuff out there. And I'll find it, take it in, absorb it, and give you my interpretation of what scholars have concluded about it. Some of my conclusions will be original. Others will be drawn from what I've read. Either way, I'll tell you where and how I think historians have it right or wrong, and I'll tell you why I think it matters today.
If you travel, you know how to pull off a perfect getaway. You know, after you enroll with your Delta SkyMiles Platinum American Express card, you get up to $10 back monthly on U.S. rideshare purchases with select providers, like a car to the airport. You know which remote retreats have the best herbal baths and where the Wi-Fi password is rarely used, because you're the escape artist. It's why you're a Delta SkyMiles Platinum American Express card member. If you travel, you know. Terms apply. Purchases must be on card. Visit go.amex/you know.
If I asked you how many subscriptions you have, would you be able to list all of them and how much you're paying? If you would have asked me this question before I started using Rocket Money, I would have said yes. But let me tell you, I would have been so wrong. I can't believe how many I had and all the money I was wasting. Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has helped save its members an average of $720 a year, with over 500 million in canceled subscriptions. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/Wondery. That's rocketmoney.com/Wondery. rocketmoney.com/Wondery.
So what kind of history are we doing here? Answering that question is essential because it guides our choice of topics and the evidence we choose to emphasize. There are many different kinds of history and a wide variety of approaches to it. Let's take politics as an example. If we wanted to talk about the political life of the late Middle Ages from, say, 1350 to 1500, we might focus on the rise of bureaucracy and the emergence of institutions that would lead to the modern sovereign state as we understand it. Or we could talk about the great nobles of Europe's kingdoms, how they resisted the expansion of the state because it trampled on their hereditary privileges and powers. Or, on the other hand, we could emphasize how those great nobles benefited from the state and encouraged its development. We might choose to downplay all of those narratives about the rise of the sovereign state and instead focus on alternative forms of political organization, like city-states. Think Venice or Milan. And leagues of towns like the Hansa of northern Germany and the Baltic. These are all viable stories and emphases to draw from just one aspect of political life in just one period. Moreover, they're all basically top-down ways of looking at it. Alternatively, we might talk about how the rise of the state and the state's desire to make war led to increased demands for taxation on common people, and how they resisted or acquiesced to those demands. The pressures of endemic war and violence on the peasantry would be another potential focus. Or we might sidestep all of that to talk about how city dwellers participated or didn't in political life. The point is this. Historians are always making choices. There is no one history, one truth of the past. Now, I think there are objective facts, and even here, there are still some historians of a postmodernist bent who would disagree with me. But the interpretation of those facts, how we put them together into narratives, topics, themes, and periods, is all up for debate. That doesn't mean all of those interpretations are equally valid, of course, but we have to be aware that there are different ways of approaching the same material. All of that leaves aside that we have to make choices about what we're going to talk about in the first place. What do we think really matters? What's important and why? I'm going to put my cards on the table here and be upfront with you all. I'm interested in big history, in big narratives, in the broad sweep of why important things happen and how they develop over time. This doesn't mean that I don't care about individuals or about the micro level of analysis. We'll have plenty of room for both on this show. But those big, deep, long-term questions and processes are what drive my interest. I want to know why sovereign states emerged in the late Middle Ages, why the Roman Empire's political system crumbled, why cities deteriorated along with the Roman state, and why the 16th century saw the first globalization, to name just a few things. Politics, war, the economy, social change, demographics, culture, and gender. The grand sweep of history is what I'm interested in. Now, a lot of academic historians would call my emphasis on these kinds of big narratives old-fashioned. They'd say it's too structural and institutional, that it's too interested in large-scale things that risk burying contrary evidence. I'm fine with all of those criticisms, and I'll tell you why. Because in turn, I think academic historians have lost sight of the fact that history should be useful. So that's the big picture of what I'm trying to do here. But throughout this series, I'm still going to be telling stories about what it would have been like to have lived through these massive social and political changes. These were people who worked and had children, loved and hated, lived and died in the shifting currents of history. There were farmers, dock workers, sailors, soldiers, priests, and aristocrats. If we want to make sense of these periods of history, we have to try to understand things from their perspective, in addition to the more abstract, big-picture view. For Fall of Rome, I've mostly done this by creating hypothetical individuals. A Goth named Vulfila, who migrated from beyond the frontier into Roman territory before ending his life in the new Visigothic kingdom of Aquitaine. A potter named Antonia, who lived in a small market town in Roman Britain as society fell apart around her. A mixed family of Romans and Franks who rose along with the Frankish kingdom in northern Gaul. And a sailor living in Carthage named Ithalus, who worked on a merchant ship that traveled around the Mediterranean. Why hypothetical individuals and not real ones? Well, for the late Roman Empire, we just don't have enough information to reconstruct the life of anybody outside the highest levels of society. Even for the best documented members of the elite, reconstructing anything like a comprehensive biography, let alone an autobiography, is out of the question. So we have to use our imaginations to put together various kinds of evidence from archaeology and texts, and then fill in the gaps to create people to help us tell that story. On occasion, we will be able to discuss real people, like the poor guy suffering from epilepsy who walked 80 miles to Rome in the middle of winter to plead his case to Pope Gregory the Great. Mostly, though, those common people are lost to us. For the late medieval and early modern periods, what we're covering in Rise of the Modern World, we have so much more evidence to talk about real, lived experience. We have tax records and legal disputes, harvest yields and customs registers, household accounts and letters written by people outside the very top ranks of society. Sometimes, these will be enough for us to embed real individuals in our story. Other times, we'll still turn to hypothetical characters, but it'll be out of choice rather than necessity. So this is what you can expect from Tides of History. In addition to those stories, I'll be bringing you interviews with knowledgeable people. We'll talk to academic historians, popular authors, and journalists. We'll dig deeper into issues that we've covered before and broach some new ones as well. Stay tuned for the first episode of the series proper, a look at the rise of the sovereign state between 1350 and 1650. In the Rise of the Modern World docket, we'll be covering the major topics of the period first: the state, war,
capitalism, the printing press, the Renaissance, the first globalization, and the Reformation. After that, we'll dig into more specific topics in broadly chronological order, starting with the Black Death and ending with the Thirty Years' War and the English Civil War. For Fall of Rome, we're going to get back on the horse with what exactly was happening in the Eastern Empire while the West was falling apart. Structurally, we'll do two episodes of each and then switch, with at least one interview episode every month as well. Thank you so much for joining me for this introductory episode, and I hope you stick around. We've got a ton of exciting stuff coming up. If you have a spare moment, I'd appreciate it if you left a rating and review. And if you haven't already, don't forget to subscribe on the Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, NPR One, or the Wondery app. You can follow me on Twitter at Patrick_Wyman, or on Facebook at Patrick Wyman MMA. And if you have questions, comments, or concerns, or if you just want to chat about the fall of the Roman Empire or the rise of the modern world, you can always drop me a line. If you want to help out even a bit more, I'd really appreciate it if you took the survey at wondery.com/survey. Tides of History is written and narrated by me, Patrick Wyman. It's engineered by Jesus Murillo. The audio design is by Jeff Schmidt. The executive producers are Jeffrey Glazer and Hernan Lopez for Wondery. Until next time, thanks for listening. From Wondery, this has been Tides of History.
If you travel, you know when it comes to love.
See you soon.
Can't wait.
The sky is no limit. You know with your Delta Amex card, being oceans apart means meeting in Aruba. And booking a war travel with your card means saving 15% on Delta flights. You know kissing under the bridge of sighs guarantees eternal love. Because you're the long-distance lovebirds. It's why you're a Delta SkyMiles Platinum American Express card member. If you travel, you know. Take off 15 discount not applicable to partner-operated flights or taxes and fees. Terms apply. Visit go.amex/you know.